to Learning by Proxy with Vivek Srinivasan. Hi everyone. Today I have a very special guest with me. I have Mr. Shyam Menon, who is partner and co-founder of the Bharat Innovation Fund. He started his career as a hardcore techie. He was a research engineer and he had done some incredible work in nano engineering. He moved more to the policy side with the China Energy Group and then working with the World Bank. Through Conduit Ventures and Nadathur Holdings, he's finally started his own fund back in 2012 in the form of Infuse Ventures, which was probably India's first sustainability-focused venture capital fund. And now he is the co-founder and partner at Bharat Innovation Fund. It's such a great honor to have you here.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So I see that all of your work has been focused towards energy in some way. You know, even a lot of your research work at the beginning was energy focused, and then you got onto the policy side, which was again energy focused. What was this thing with energy? What attracted you about that?
Honestly, it wasn't by design. I was a metallurgist by training and, you know, studied materials engineering, graduated. You know, problem was when I was graduating from my master's in the US, that time in 2000, 2001, there was really not many jobs in the market. There was nothing to do. And especially when you studied material science, the biggest problem was you had to be a US citizen or have a green card for many of the kind of research roles in materials, because everything had something to do with defense, you know, or something that had a security clearance requirement, which I could never get as an Indian citizen. So I was wondering, now what? And I had never intended to enter energy or climate change or any of it. I just went for a conference once and got a catalog from that conference, which had a lot of startups across material science listed. And I called every one of them, starting alphabet A, and I alphabet P. It was finally there. I got a startup called Tal Materials, which was doing something, some very early stage work out of University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, in the nanomaterial space. It was like a 4-member team. They couldn't believe that I even found the startup. It was an actual garage startup in a garage in Ann Arbor, Michigan, started by a bunch of PhD students at Ann Arbor. And it was a random call which led to a small position with a young startup. I was one of the first 4 engineers. And we were, you know, trying to do something very cool with something called mixed metal oxide nanoparticulate powders. Now, I didn't know for what in the world they were trying to make this when I joined them. They took me because I was a ceramic engineer. Now, once we got in there, I realized even they didn't know what the use case was going to be. And they were also trying to figure it out. There were only 4 people as it is. So then we ended up sending our small batches of powders, you're talking 5 gram powders, to a lot of defense-related and energy-related institutions to see if they could use it for certain part of their research work.
Right.
Finally, that is what led to the first order we got, was from General Dynamics in the US. And we never quite understood. It was a defense contractor. But then we realized later on that they were using the material, nanomaterial particulate powder we were developing to make electrodes for microfuel cells to fit into a UAV, a drone, the size of an insect. You're talking in year 2001. I mean, this is that early. I mean, almost 25 years or 24 years ago. And that's kind of when you understand the level of advancement of US defense. It's just another level. But that was what they were using it for. They were developing microfuel cells, basically the size of insects. And they wanted a fuel cell-based power so that it will be silent and the output is only water vapor, right? So you can't detect it from a detection perspective. So it really had no climate change or energy angle. It was a defense angle. It was surveillance. But this is what started the journey. I mean, that entry point into understanding that nanomaterial particulate powder could become potentially electrode materials for microfuel cells, which can be the size of insects. That's what led me down the path of thinking, oh, fuel cells is an option. Hydrogen, you know, I mean, in year 2001, I had never, climate change was not a word even I had even thought about, you know, I mean, it's just something that I landed just because this is where the first startup I ended up working for, you know, was going down the path of. And one thing led to another in my career of 25 years has been around energy, the energy value chain, deep technologies and whatnot. So it started completely randomly with a catalog out of a conference center.
Wow. Some story. So, you know, you get this catalog, you get into research. Then what switches you to policy?
So again, it was the difficulty of being an international student in a country like the US at a time when they didn't quite understand what startups were. So the problem that, you know, you have as a Indian national or any national, doesn't matter, in the US is that, you know, you have to be on an H-1B visa. Correct. And which is what we were on. But the problem is when you are on a startup, with a startup, startups don't have money to pay you most of the time. So you're working for no salary for half the time. So when you're working for no salary, then you can't pay tax. But then if you're not paying tax, then the question comes from IRS. They're like, then what are you doing here? Right? If you're not paying tax, then you shouldn't be here. Right? I mean, like, if you're working, that means in theory, you should have an income. That means you should be paying a tax. So what I realized very early on, I think that problem has been mitigated to some extent now, with there is an understanding what startups are and that, you know, startups may not have recurring revenue to be able to pay initial engineers, etc. That understanding was just not there in the US immigration system back 25 years ago. So it was a constant battle for young immigrants like me in working in startups, having to justify what we were doing. Because at certain times of the year, you don't have any income tax to show. So this is then I finally got fed up of the whole battle, you know, trying to convince, you know, INS what was going on, you know, that these are startups. Startups have a different journey. And I was thinking, okay, this battle can't keep going on forever. Let me just see if I should try and get another degree. And I was thinking about a material science PhD, but then I was getting tired of being technical for so long, wanted to explore policy, applied for a program, landed up in California, and my advisor directed me to go talk to Lawrence Berkeley National Lab because they were trying to do some very interesting work looking at the low carbon energy transition pathways in China and India. I actually spoke to the India head, but India head already had two or three postdocs. Already. So then I went and spoke to the China head at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, and the China head and I hit it off. And then we were like, okay, let's do this. And then I was trying to work on what was called, we were looking at mapping what was actually the energy consumption in China at that point of time, 2003, 4, 5, doing a ground up study, looking at what is the transportation energy use in China, looking at the number of vehicles on the ground and back calculating from that and the engine type and the distance traveled, what is the actual energy consumption in the transport sector? Now, you can ask why this thesis, why go down this path? What had happened around that time, I don't know if you remember or recall, there was a sort of a notion in the energy world that somehow China had managed to decouple itself from the energy use and GDP growth, which honestly was, it was insane. It was not going to be possible at all. But that was the claim, you know? I mean, their data was showing barely any energy growth, but GDP was growing like crazy. We're like, how does this make any sense? And so what we were doing from Lawrence Berkeley Lab was trying to bottom up model and understand actually what is the energy consumption in China, especially for each sector. So we had different teams working on transport, on buildings, on different parts of the ecosystem. My work was on transport at that point of time. So we used to figure out all the kinds of different vehicles. And China has a million types of Jugaad vehicles. It's unbelievable. I mean, when you get down to the nitty-gritty, you realize how ingenious people are in China. It's incredible. And then we find the kind of vehicles they have and their engine types and their average distance traveled per year. And then you create this massive statistical model. And then you're trying to predict from that what is the actual consumption. And that's when we understood the real energy patterns in China. And then the thought process was, if at all China had to move towards a low carbon pathway, what is it that they would need to do? So now that you have built this ginormous model after, you know, years of work, now try to see if you can use it from a policy input perspective and see if you can look at different pathways. So I was a multivariate statistical modeler. I actually wasn't looking at the policy. I was actually on the modeling side. But then once I modeled it, naturally policy was an extension of that work. So one thing led to another, and that led to the World Bank. Because the World Bank was doing, in the World Bank, there is something called the Development Economics Research Group, which is sort of the research nucleus of the World Bank. And at the director of the research program at that point of time, a gentleman called Dr. Zmarek Shalizi, he was just a brilliant gentleman. He was very keen on doing a comparative study on potential evolution of China and India and the different pathways these two countries might take. And there was this big study that the World Bank had sanctioned called the Dancing with the Giants. It was a comparison of India and China and multiple sectors and how it will evolve. And, you know, what will be the energy and the impact and emissions and environmental impact and everything. So this was a ginormous experiment, study across multiple sectors, divisions and departments in the World Bank. We were one small part of it, you know, in doing the energy and emissions evaluation. But there's a lot of work going on across the bank on that topic. And we somehow my work at the at Lawrence Berkeley Lab got pulled into this work that was going on at the World Bank. And I ended up moving from Berkeley to DC and then ended up being part of that program. It was very interesting times actually at the World Bank, because when I joined in about end of 2005, what was going on was that there was something called the Gleneagles Summit, where the G7 countries had met. And they had come out just around the time I was joining with this big position on climate change, saying that the World Bank will come up with what's called the Clean Energy Investment Framework. And the International Energy Agency will come up with what's called the Energy Technology Roadmap, which kept coming out annually after that. But this decision was taken in Scotland, in Gleneagles, at this G7 summit. And now the problem was, when they came out with this notion of clean energy investment framework, which the World Bank was supposed to spearhead, the problem was the World Bank operates on a top-down macroeconomic modeling perspective. And what they wanted to do this was bottom-up modeling on what actually happens at each level rather than a top-down modeling impact. And the World Bank at that point barely had any bottom-up economists or microeconomists or modelers looking at this kind of work. And this is how my journey intersected with the program at the World Bank and ended up being part of that journey for some time before becoming a VC.
I mean, it's insane to think about it that, I mean, the first so-called VC investment was Intel, right? I mean, that was like in the 70s and 2000, yeah. You're still telling me that these guys still didn't have so much of an idea of what a startup is and why are you doing this? Why are you doing this charity work?
Especially from the immigration perspective, right? I mean, different departments of the government may understand things better, but the immigration side, you know, figures out if you are legitimate or not by looking at your tax return. Now, when you're in a startup which doesn't have money to pay you regularly, you know, it's difficult to show that. I mean, all of these were, I think, more growing pains. All these must have gotten sorted out over the years. But, you know, but when you are going through it, you are going through it.
So the other thing being that in 2005, you were looking at carbon emission, like this is almost two decades ago, you were looking at how carbon emission is going to ramp up in China. And I'm sure the writing was on the wall even back then.
Yeah. And it was a hard journey. I mean, because there were no established methodologies on how to calculate any of these things. We had to come up with our own methodologies and then find approval. So it was a very strange job. We were multivariate statistical modelers who had to go sell our methodology to multiple countries in the world to show that this is the way to do this kind of measurements. So actually, I ended up working very closely at that point of time with the World Resource Institute, WRI.
Really?
And a gentleman who I'll never forget, who had a very strong role in my life, was a gentleman called Dr. Lee Shipper, who was the director at that point of time. Just an absolute genius of a human being and an amazing human being. So it was with him and the World Bank that we co-wrote a lot of publications, which created the kind of baseline template methodology for transportation sector emissions measurements, which became the basis for WRI's work in India many years later, a decade later, when I somehow happened to go to the WRI office in Bombay, completely not expecting anything. I was just happened to be there for some meeting in Bombay. And I saw, a document actually, as you enter their office, placed in the, just sort of the coffee table, and it had my name on it. And I was like, I couldn't even remember what this was. And then I realized they were using that methodology work that was done with WRI a decade ago, became kind of the baseline for the sort of transportation energy emissions measurement, methodology that was used in the beginning by WRI in India. But I am sure it has evolved a lot more since then. What we had done was very preliminary, very basic, but I'm sure it has all evolved a lot more. But, sometimes that's when you realize that the kind of work you do on the policy side, it may take decades later and somewhere you see it, and then you feel very happy that you had some small role to play, in the evolution of that journey.
Yeah, I mean, policy it can have a very far-ranging effect on, how things work out, how things happen because of the nature of it. That's such an incredible story. You are statistical modeler, so you go from, World Bank into the world of investment, understandable. And so you're in London and you quit this job and you come back to India and you set up a fund.
Yeah.
And it's not easy to set up a fund.
It's hard. Yeah.
It's really hard because you need to talk to, all of these different LPs, you have to convince them to actually pledge money with you to make investments on a thesis.
Yeah.
That's also very, very like fresh. Like you're saying sustainable VC, this is like not very prevalent in 2012 when you started this out. So,
right.
And I don't even know when you went pitching this because you might have gone
there.
In 2010 and managed to raise in 12. How does a man decide to do that to himself?
I don't know. I mean, sometimes you realize, a lot of these things, when you're going through these journeys, you don't even know what you're doing. You're just doing it, and then it's all later on, you're trying to make sense of your own journey. I mean, even the journey to London and the VC world was, it was complete happenstance. It was kind of funny. There was a startup that this particular venture capital fund was trying to fundraise for. And they had reached out to IFC for funding. And okay. IFC, the person who was heading investments team for the sustainable energy division at the IFC at that point of time was a friend of mine who had reached out to me because this startup that they had a deck on was a hydrogen and fuel cell startup. And there was nobody in their team who understood fuel cells. It came on my desk. It just said, just give us your view. And some discussions happened. And I gave some comments. One thing led to another. I ended up meeting the general partner of the fund when he ended up coming to DC, Washington. And then because many years ago, look at all the coincidences, right? Some 2 decades before that, when he was an MBA student, he had done some work at the World Bank. So he still had relationships there. So whenever he would ever come to Washington, he would just pop over and say hello to his friends. It was in this context that he ended up meeting me. And then we ended up talking and he said, why don't you come and join us? We are a small venture fund. they had raised a 35 million euro fund in London to do very early stage deep tech work in hydrogen. And the problem was the four of them were all bankers. None of them had a single degree or background in technology or hydrogen or fuel cells or any of it. But they could raise money because they came from the banking side. They were private bankers from Solomon Smith and Barney, Citibank, etc. So they came from that world, but they were not, you know, tech people, deep tech people or any of it. So they needed somebody who had been on the fuel cell actual engineering side to evaluate these startups. So there were four people. I was just the fifth person. We were a small team. And then when I went and joined them, they were just at the tail end of fund one and raising fund two. So the general partner would take me whenever he would go fundraising. So I would see what he's doing, you know, and that's how I learned fundraising. And then I realized years later, I want to come and do this something in India, you know, and in the middle, there was a stint of a year or whatever in Singapore, but the whole intent was to move back and try and raise a fund, you know, in India, looking at climate tech. And there was nothing happening in climate tech in India at that time. And I got a good opportunity to meet with Kunal, who became my partner, who was running the incubation arm at IIM Ahmedabad, called CIIE. Now it's called IMA Ventures. Now, that was an interesting time. So what had happened at that time was Kunal has been running the incubator from 2007. So he is an IMA graduate, IT Madras IMA graduate. He had already done a startup in the water space and all that. And so he had come back to campus to set up this incubator, which was starting out, which had already been operational for maybe 3-4 years now at that point. And what he was also realizing was, I mean, if you were not doing e-commerce or something, there was really no money for anybody on doing anything else, you know? And at that point of time, the National Solar Mission related some programmatic funding, small loans program was routed via CIIE or IMA Ventures. It was kind of a agency, a small agency of sorts that the government of India used to identify young entrepreneurs who are building, you know, sort of project developer toolkits for, you know, in India. So they were a vehicle to disburse those loans for solar.
Administrators.
Exactly, administrators. So that was one place where CIE also started getting involved in the whole solar startup world. But then at the startup accelerator also, we were getting a lot of entrepreneurs applying with all kinds of ideas in energy efficiency, waste to value, renewables, cold chain, green chemicals. But then there was no funding beyond that 30, 40, 50 lakhs that the startup accelerator was able to give them. So this was the point when the thought was going on with Kunal, thinking we should do something, you know, to support this ecosystem. And he ended up having a really supportive, good meeting with, at that point of time, MNRE secretary. Her name was Gauri Singh. She was one of the most instrumental people who helped us get off the ground. She then became head of IRENA, International Renewable Energy, IRENA agency in Abu Dhabi. So she was the MNRE secretary at that time and very, very supportive of what we wanted to do. So that meeting, when Kunal met with Gauri, I mean, the whole thesis was that, you know, entrepreneurs in India need some support if they have to develop something for climate tech. You know, I mean, you can't do this on your own, right? You need some early stage equity support. Debt is just not going to be available for them. So that was where the conversations were. After I got involved, once I got introduced to Kunal and we decided to team up to do this, we decided to go all out and try and find money, because finally the arrangement we got with Ministry of New and Renewable Energy is that they would allocate a certain portion of capital to us. We would have to find matching dollars from private sector, matching rupees. So that was the thesis. Now, we went out and somehow took 2 years, but managed to find 4x of the money. So we managed to get IFC to come in, British Petroleum, ICICI Bank, Union Bank, completely random. We went and talked to anybody and everybody who would give us time of day. Just somehow convinced people. That's all I did for 2 years. I came back and I was just running around trying to do that in Bombay. I'd never worked a day of my life in India. I had gone straight after engineering. 15 years later, I'm coming back. I had never worked a day here. I landed in Bombay and I just started going bank to bank, speaking to treasury heads, trying to see if they will do an allocation from the equity book, not from the debt side. Mm-hmm. And it was a very difficult sell, but somehow managed to get some good, well-meaning investors. So SIDBI came in, Technology Development Board, TDB came in, IFC came in, BP came in, Godrej, Nadir Godrej, of now the chairman of Godrej Industries, he came in. So good quality names, good quality people. We were able to, it took a lot of time, but they were good quality names and they all put a small check to finally get to about 100 crores, small fund, seed fund, which was the start of the Infuse journey. And, you know, the funny part at that point of time was we finally raised this money, but then we realized the pipeline in India was so weak because nobody was even curating a pipeline in 2012. So then we went out and got a small grant pot from ADB, Asian Development Bank. And then we ran something called PowerStart, which was the first climate tech focused startup accelerator that we ran for multiple years, where we would source business plans from all over the country in related to climate tech, go through about whatever 70, 80, 100 applications, and then identify maybe 25 to 30 of them, bring these founders to campus to IMA, and then take them through a few days intense program to help them shape up their business plan. Then take them through a process of where we identify maybe four or five of them who we think are worth supporting. We started out with a small grant of 50 odd lakhs. Then we'll see over the next couple of years how they would evolve. And then we decide if we do an equity check. This is how the whole journey started. Because we didn't even have a pipeline, you know, at that point of time. There were no seed investors, no angels, no nothing in the climate sector. So it was a really hard time. But somehow managed to do all that and get that ecosystem moving. But still, it was difficult as a fund because there was really not nobody else on the VC side who would do a follow-on investment. You know, after we would do 3-4 crores or 5 crores of investment, where do they go when they need a 5 million check? Right? I mean, there was really no VC money in the market. So in some ways, I mean, maybe we were just too early for the whole thing. You know, maybe a time like now may be better because there's a general more acceptance of the space. But back then it was just too early from a follow-on investor perspective. But still some of the good quality companies in our portfolio did manage to frugally survive and grow. And some of them became very big, like Fourth Partner Energy, which became a very large solar company and all that. I mean, so, you know, thank God that, you know, we had some successes because that is helping us at least return, you know, the capital back to our investors and, you know, hopefully give them some kind of meaningful return now that it's about a, you know, decade plus that journey has started. That's been the journey on Infuse. It has been definitely a long, long journey on that one.
I mean, I got started with the Indian startup ecosystem like back in 2013. And I know, I mean, even otherwise, the deal flow was not.
It was not very good. Forget climate tech, right? I mean, climate tech was different.
Generally speaking, it wasn't great. It was not until maybe 2015, 16, 17 that like the whole thing started to explode.
Really picked up.
Given, you know, all of these, you know, aspects of working with these climate tech startups, what was the market like for them? I mean, there's the other side of the equation, which is these guys have to go and sell their solution.
Sell something, right? Yeah. It was really hard, yes. Very hard. I mean, because there was no, even today, you barely have a green premium. Back then, the concept of green premium didn't exist at all. No one would ever pay for it. So it had to, all of these startups had to survive just on the basis of the pure economic merit of the product. I mean, so if you're selling energy efficiency, nobody is buying energy efficiency. They're just buying a cost reduction for whatever it is. Same thing, if you're doing green chemicals, nobody cares if it's green. They're only buying it because it is cheaper than your existing chemical product or whatever, right? So that is the realization, was that there was very little room for you to ride the cost curve because nobody was willing to give you the room to ride the cost curve down, because any new technology cost curve, it'll start high. You have to be able to go down the curve. It was very difficult. So we realized that we can't be doing deep technology kind of investing in climate tech in India because there was no space to ride the cost curve down. So we had to look for more near to market solutions. and try and see, you know, if we can play on some market inefficiency in enabling adoption and not focus on a new technology that you have to ride the cost curve down because no one will pay for the delta in the beginning. So okay. This was the basic shift in thinking compared to the work I did in Europe, where we were betting on next generation hydrogen technologies is being spun out of large corporates like Volvo and this and that. That was a very different kind of investing in deep technology, hydrogen value chain companies coming out of large corporates versus in India, where we were trying to solve for more near-term market inefficiencies to enable adoption. So it was a very different mentality we had to take to be able to do this, because we knew there was no way for anybody to pay a premium for carbon, you know, to write that down. So we had to think of some other reason. I mean, just to give you an example, I mean, it was a deal that it didn't really go very far. It was a portfolio company that unfortunately did not make it. But multiple companies that did not make it, but who were working on some phenomenal things. So one of the startups, I'll give you two examples of. One of them was working on geo-cooling. And I'll tell you the concept there was, this was a high-tech company which couldn't ride the cost curve down, which was one only company which was really, really high-tech that we went after. Now, the thesis was so appealing. The thesis was that, you know, in places like India, where you have outside temperatures that can go to late 30s to early 40s to even close to 50 in some places, centigrade, centigrade, you know, conventional air conditioning is really not the right solution because, you know, conventional air conditioning requires you to take the heat from inside the building and expel it outside. And the outside temperature is this high. You know, how does it make any sense? Whereas if you go 100 feet below the ground, you hit a 23, 24 degree constant temperature and you're much better off rejecting heat under the ground versus into a 40, 45 degree furnace, which is what you have in India. Whereas if you think of air conditioning, it was developed in the West, you know, where you never face this sort of 40 degree temperatures outside, right? So they didn't have to worry about rejecting heat into an atmosphere which was that hot, you know, whereas in India, that's a natural thing. So since air conditioning was not developed in the tropics, our basic view was air conditioning should be thought of differently in the tropics. It cannot be done the same way that you would have done it in Europe, you know, or North America. And the startup had phenomenal tech around it and whatnot. But we realized very quickly that there are so many things in that journey that they have to, you know, to get correct real product market fit, that their technology development would need about $40 to $50 million. And we managed to put whatever we put plus managed to get another European investor to come in. But even after that, there was just not enough capital to ride that cost curve down on proving geo-cooling in India. I mean, it was sad in that sense. And I'll give you another example. Again, a startup that did not work versus what worked, who was trying to solve a very near-term market inefficiency. I mean, if you look at agriculture in India, I mean, one thing we have abundantly in agriculture in India is actually solar energy. Why don't you use solar-based water pumping? Was our one thesis is, you know, everywhere you used to hear farmers complaining they don't have power to run the water pump. And the one thing we have, without a doubt, everywhere is enough and more sun. You know, our thesis is, why are we not using solar water pumping? I mean, why on earth are we depending on the grid for this? You know, and so then we started figuring out what the problems were, worked with a startup that was addressing this problem. They found a near-term financial engineering fix to be able to solve for the capex. Everything we managed to prove. Then we ended up running into a very unique India-centric problem, which is anytime you get close to some election or the other, no matter what state, wherever, the especially local politicians who are quoting farmers, what they would end up doing is they would say that they will promise free solar water pumps or, you know, something like that. And then the reality is they may not end up actually ever giving it. But then when you make a promise like this, you cannot run a business because the farmer is now expecting that he'll get a free pump or he will get his entire loans all, you know, cleaned up. I mean, he won't have to pay the loans off, right? I mean, he'll get pardoned. So we were running into this problem all the time that even though the startup had figured out the financing solutions, got the bank partners, got the right sort of solar water pumping solution with proper variable speed drives embedded in it to maximize efficiency, we solved the technology problem, financing problem, loan disbursement problem, and then you run into a local politics problem, which was, because of the promises made by local politicians, many farmers were not willing to even get into this financing arrangement because their view is that anyway, by this election, I'll get it for free. But then the reality is they don't get it. Most of the 99% of the time, they don't get it. But because such promises are being made, you end up not being able to get a real business going. So then you realize that India is very unique. I mean, it's got so many issues that are not typical in the West. So what you cannot see in a business plan, you run into on the ground here, and that's a lot of learnings that we've had in our journey.
So you mentioned geo cooling and like, but the first time I went to Iceland, I was so surprised that, all the buildings in Reykjavik are heated with geothermal energy. And so the first question there was, didn't you try to explore international markets with these startups or, look
I
at
mean, this was intended for to support the local ecosystem here. I mean, this was not created with the international market in mind. We created Infuse to support climate startups trying to solve something locally, and we had very little money, 3-4 crores. What on earth are they going to do internationally with that kind of money? I mean, you need to raise serious capital if you want to try to build a product and then try to sell abroad and create a go-to-market there. You need $5-10 million, which they didn't have. I mean, so it was not a realistic, option for us to look at international markets. Our thesis changed significantly in Bharat Innovation, which is looking at global deep tech from India, looking at startups building for the world from India. In fact, India is not even 10% of the market in our Bharat Innovation Fund portfolio. 90% of the market is global. So, so it's a very different thesis. Infuse was a very different thesis, actually.
So Infuse was your first fund and like it's been 12 years. Typically a venture fund when you create it, you're expecting to close it in 7, 8 years, nine
Yeah.
max.
It's exiting now, finally.
Did you anticipate it would run over a decade?
I mean, we didn't, it is what it is here. I mean, these companies are very young. They're seed stage companies. There was no follow-on investment. So naturally, things are going to take their own time. India being India, companies don't die that easily. So they survive. They struggle, but they fight it out. I mean, they survive somehow, right? I mean, kudos to so many of our founders. In spite of such hard times, they've kept at it for so long. I mean, so many of them. Some of them did fold along the way, but a few of them kept going, and I have a lot of, lot of respect for them. It's not easy to have survived this long with very limited capital. Of course, that market is changing now. Hopefully, things will get better. Let's see. But I mean, but we have moved on to more deep tech now. So, our focus is now far more global deep tech, actually.
And but in terms of climate technologies or climate-focused startups, what is the difference that you see between Infuse and
I mean, there's just a lot more confidence in founders, so they're doing a lot more things. They're willing to experiment a lot more, and there's a lot more seed money available. So, getting that first 5-6 crores is no longer that difficult. You can get it. You'll still get it out of the seed and angel system. Of course, it's still, I am not saying it's easy for climate tech founders. It's still hard. Fundraising is very difficult. Even today, getting that first 5 mil, then the next 5 mil is not easy in climate tech. But definitely 10x better than what it was when Infuse was launched, but it's still not at all easy if in the climate tech space. Maybe if you're doing something purely software, which has other applications outside of the climate tech market, you might still be fine. But especially if you're doing hardware or deep science, it's much harder to raise money. I mean, that has always been the case everywhere in the world. It's not just India. Everywhere it's the same story. So it's not easy, but if you have a solution that can go across sectors and climate is only one of them, you might be in a better place to raise money because there are multiple markets you can target. Also, the basic problem with climate tech and venture capital as an asset class basically is that end of the day, what are you making? In climate tech, you're making power, water, chemicals. These are all commodities. You know, there is a limit to what you can charge for them, you know, for power or water or chemicals, right? And that's the issue, is that because you are charging only commodity level pricing, you know, there is a limit to the margins you can make. And you are up against very strong incumbents who have been servicing these sectors. Whereas when you're talking pure internet-based businesses, many a time you are in a completely new blue ocean space, right? They're new spaces. So you are creating a market, new market. Whereas here you are competing with very, very strong large incumbents. So which is a much harder play, you know? And also you're selling a commodity product where you cannot really price it much higher. You know, I mean, how much more can you price power? You know, how much more can you price water or chemicals and things like that? So, you know, or food produce, you know, you can't price it too much higher. I mean, yeah, you have organic food now, maybe you can price that a little higher, but there is still a limit. There's a threshold for pricing for stuff in the climate tech area, which are the output of these industries. So, which is another reason why you don't, you know, you are, maybe venture capital is not the right toolkit many a time for many of these industries. You know, I mean, certain elements of climate tech may be venture backable, but for other elements, maybe, you know, VC may not even be the right toolkit.
Right. Interesting. So in terms of, let's say, trends that you're seeing, what are like three major trends that you're seeing in sustainability and climate?
It's all general, like nothing unique. I mean, naturally the EV transition started, which is good. You know, I mean, it should have started. I mean, I'm glad it started in India now. I mean, it has been going on in the West for a long time. And in India, it has started in the right way, which is two-wheelers, three-wheelers, which makes a lot more sense than four-wheeler. Because four-wheeler mobility, you know, where people depend on it for transport has not been the way India grew anyway. India never grew that way. India has grown more the two, three-wheeler and buses, etc. So that two, three-wheeler and bus transition is the more logical transition in electric vehicles, which is the right transition India is doing. Another area, I think, is food and agri efficiency improvements needed to happen anyway, because our food production efficiencies were, I remember long back a statistic that said that we were almost 60% more inefficient than China in food production. I mean, not even with the West, even in comparison with China. This was a few years ago. I don't know if we've caught up or not. But so, you know, there are a lot of room for improvement in areas like that. Then, which is good to see. Energy efficiency and stuff, I am yet to see a real pickup in India. Maybe it's just that our pricing for power and all is just still too low for it to make a real meaningful impact for industry. Because if you are an industry owner and you have 1,000 rupees to spend, you have 150 demands on that 1,000 rupees, and power price is in the last bucket. You know, I mean, it's not the primary motivator, you know, for the owner to spend money on something. So to me, that is the reason, is that because these things are not priced right, you know, whether it is power or water, etc., you know, that is why that incentive to reduce their consumption or optimize it is not as much, because it's not priced correctly to start with, right? I mean, water is treated as a public good, and when you don't really pay anything for it or very little, then where is your incentive to save it, right? But then if you're like in Singapore, where your water bill can actually be more than your power bill, or you know, you can buy alcohol for cheaper than water, you know, then you start looking at how you consume water. So that's the thing. Eventually, you know, price is a phenomenal mover of markets. If you can price things correctly, the markets will move, because markets have a reason to move. But if you don't price it and then you're just using policy, you know, then people will always try to find a workaround. If you price things right, you will get a market. Market will move and do the work for you.
Correct. And what do you think about waste?
See, waste, again, tricky in India. What we have seen is there are too many other factors. We looked at so many waste to value deals back in Infuse. It's become a little better. But wherever we were dealing with agri waste, again, the whole problem was agri waste collection, and then, you know, moving it to a central location for processing and dealing with local politics. Because the moment you get into all this kind of stuff, agri waste or municipal waste, you're dealing with factors that you normally can't account for in a business plan. You know, like, what is the lay of the land of the local politics there, you know, and all that becomes very key to these things. And, you know, you have to be very careful in how you deal with all this sort of spaces. I mean, this is not about a technology or a clear go-to-market. I mean, there are all kinds of other things involved here, which are not easy to plan for, you know, and how do you deal with all these scenarios, you know? And so that has been the tricky part in waste has been generally with collecting it and transporting it and the problems associated with all that. Then, of course, if you had a policy driver that says that you should use a certain percentage of recycled whatever for whatever use, yeah, you will incentivize the market. You know, I mean, yes, policy drivers can be useful. But the problem in India that we saw, I mean, take electronic waste processing, for example. We had a startup in our portfolio in Infuse, which again didn't work out because the enforcement was not there for that policy back in 2012-13. People found a workaround by getting organized players to collect the waste from industry for electronic waste. And the organized player in turn would then pass it back to the unorganized player for processing. So then where is the, what have you solved for? You've not solved for anything. You just created one more layer in the middle. You know what I mean? So we realize that intent is there in India. Laws are there, but then it's not enforced. If you're then not enforcing it, then, you know, how do you build a sustainable business on top of it, right? That intent should be enforced, you know? I mean, then you would have the right, the startups be able to do the right thing. Because a startup that takes money from a VC fund like us has to be in 100% compliance. It cannot be cutting corners, you know? So you need enforcement on the side of the law to ensure that everybody has the same cost base. When the unorganized sector for waste processing does not have any cost to deal with, whereas the startups have to deal with everything from registration costs to waste processing cost to pollution tax to this to that, and the unorganized doesn't pay anything, it's the playing field is not the same. If it's not equal, what do you do? Then how do you ever make money, right? You can never compete with an unorganized player because he is not going through any of these costs. He doesn't have to bear these costs. Whereas the startup has to bear it from day one.
Very true.
I mean, so these are the sort of learnings that you go through in this journey.
Amazing. So, I mean, I typically do 20-minute podcast. This has already run an hour. Thank you so very much for patiently sharing all of your insights, all of your stories and great anecdotes. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you so very much for your time. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thank you.